The time for talking is over.
The match clock showing 4 hours and 12 minutes.
Thibodeau locks in.
Gonna have a short for him inside in. Murray, they are running for
it. He's got it. What's the smash like? It's good. It's good from Porter.
Sits it back. And ace out wide.
And Arena Sabalenka collapses on Rod Laver Arena.
And it is 10 of the absolute best for Novak Djokovic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the AO Show for another week of tennis news, views, and interviews. I'm John Hoovenaars, and here's what's coming up on the show. Craig Tiley reflects on a record-breaking Australian Open.
The biggest Grand Slam ever in the history of Grand Slams.
Sister Act, the rise of Linda and Brenda Frevertova.
We don't really want people to compare us with Serena and Venus, you know, because we just want to do us.
And Record Hunter. Who does Novak Djokovic have next in his sights for AO 24?
She won 33 matches in a row, so Novak could surpass that with a deep run.
That's all ahead on the AO Show.
Watching the tennis in a country that I'm visiting for holidays.
The atmosphere, just people all enjoying themselves and coming together, and Melbourne looking at its best.
Good atmosphere, like many activities.
And it looks amazing. I just love it. The people,
the atmosphere.
Well, we're from America, and I've seen the U.S. Open, Flushing Meadow, this facility. And this facility is phenomenal. I mean, what they've done here, Craig Tiley's done here, is pretty special.
Pretty special indeed was Australian Open 2023. More than 839,000 fans through the gates of Melbourne Park across the main draw, eclipsing the previous attendance record by more than 25,000, which must be music to the ears of the tournament director, Craig Tiley. Welcome back to the AO Show.
Don't know if it feels like a day, a week, a month, a year, but it's great to be back, and it's great to be back now after we've completed a monumental summer of tennis, and we're very proud of what was achieved. If you bring in the qualifying, which is the first year we ticketed the qualifying this year, it was great to welcome, you know, that many fans. Oh, no, actually over 900,000 fans with qualifying over the 3 weeks in January.
It just occurred to me that as we are recording this, 10:30 on the 16th was exactly a month after the opening of the gates for day one.
Yeah, the month goes by quickly. When you start the event, you think, oh, we've got a big mountain to climb. And then before you know it, it's finished. And it's always a time that I love the finals, but I don't enjoy the fact that it's over, because there's such a buzz, and the amount of adrenaline that runs through everyone during that period of time, I think, is pretty high. And it's magnificent feeling to be able to entertain fans from around the world, and particularly people from Australia and Victoria. And to do what we did. So I'm very proud of what was achieved. The biggest Grand Slam ever in the history of Grand Slams.
Yeah, that is some title. And I want to take your mind back to some of the great action we saw on court throughout the tournament. A new champion in the women's side. And who would have thought that the best women's match would be reserved for day 13?
It was an unbelievable final. The best I've seen. And both deserve a lot of credit, because They're great tennis players, and it's fantastic to see on the women's side of the game. I've always said and I don't want to get too far down the track on the discussion around equality. We made a decision over 35 years ago to offer equal prize money to men and women when it wasn't popular, and kudos to the people that made that call, because it would have been one that came with a lot of criticism. But we've perpetuated that and kept that going. And the investment in women's and men's tennis has been the same, has been equal all along the journey. It's a business decision. And there was a great example. Prime time, Saturday night, around the world, in Australia, you see some of the best tennis played by two remarkable female athletes. And so it was great to be sitting courtside and watching that, because it was magnificent tennis. And here you got someone like Sabalenka, who's always been on the verge of making that breakthrough, winning a slam here and doing so well. Been really excited about it, and I know the next morning, on top of being really tired, she really enjoyed the accolades she received and be able to get dressed up and enjoy the trophy walk.
So much had been written about the turmoil she went through over the past 12 months with her serve, and you would have seen some of that emotion last year. I think she had 99 double faults in January of 2022. To see a player overcome those sorts of mental demons and then come out the other side as the best in the world, effectively.
Well, as a former coach, I look with more of a critical eye at all these things, and for an athlete to turn around their experience like that, serving nearly 100 double faults, which is remarkable. It's giving away 100 points, 99 points, actually handing them to your opponent. And at this level, you don't win when you do that. There's no, you have no chance. But to go from that to where she was and how she played this summer is really a remarkable achievement. So credit to her coaches, to herself, because ultimately it's on her. She's the one who's got to do it. And her approach to pressure. She was playing a Grand Slam final, and there was talk about it's going to break down because it's a Grand Slam final. Yeah. The pressure's high. But she stepped up, and it just shows not only resilience, but the remarkable athlete that she actually is. And I think we're going to see a lot more of her play at that level, and she's realized now how good she is, and the world has seen how good she is. And behind the scenes, really easy to deal with, always got a smile, very friendly to everyone. And, you know, she's a high-performing athlete, so they're going to always be on edge. But she has a nice way about it, for sure.
16 Australian Opens as tournament director. Yeah. 10 of those have been won by one man, Novak Djokovic.
Yeah.
It's almost incomprehensible how successful he's been here.
It's kind of like Rafa winning 14 at in Roland Garros on the clay, but this is remarkable. It's a hard court. It's the beginning of the year. It's there's a lot of variables that can make that change, and he's remarkable. I haven't been around an athlete so maniacally focused on performance every single day, every single minute of every single day as he is, and the results speak for themselves. This was a particularly emotional year for Novak.
Yeah.
Novak came in, I could see the tension on his face when I saw him the first time, and we'd met a few times last year, and I know that you knew that he was feeling nervous about coming back to Australia. He was very nervous when he first arrived and flew directly into Adelaide, and there was a lot of press and talk around him coming in and him being booed, and I kept on saying that you need to give much bigger credit to the Australian sporting public that enjoy a sport. Come watch it. We are the fairest in the world, and when we're observing greatness, we respect it and we'll cheer accordingly. And that's exactly what happened. And he was really welcomed back and went through a tough time last year for a number of different reasons, primarily driven by his own choice. But I saw the negativity that swirled around everything that happened and experienced it, but he came in, and once he got settled, I think in Adelaide did a magnificent job. South Australia did really well with their sport, did a magnificent job welcoming him, and once he got settled, and then he started to play, and then I watched him play that final at the Adelaide International and get over the top when he probably should have lost that.
Yeah, Seb Korda.
Yeah, we get play against Seb Korda, who's a great player for the future too, and then I knew coming in, he was going to be tough to beat.
That's a real show of faith by you in the Australian sporting public, because this can be a hostile environment, I guess, politically at times, away from the sporting field. But for you to have the faith in our fans to say to Novak, you know, they're fair, they appreciate greatness, they will respect what you do.
It's so true. We talked earlier about the players make the event, the staff put on make the event, but the fans are the biggest part of the event. And I told Novak the whole time, and everyone said, "Oh, you're just saying that. You know, you're just saying that. That's how it's going to be." And I said, "No, I honestly believe. I could be wrong, but I honestly believe that's what's going to happen. You get the one or two individuals, but they're going to be drowned out by those that are really enjoying it. And it is what happened, and it'll happen again. And I've said this from day one. Even before I moved to Australia, I thought the Australian sporting fan were the best, because they really." They have a great passion for it. They understand it, and everyone comes to it, and we respect it. And so I think that that's why it's a privilege for the players to play in front of the fans they do.
And a real privilege to come together on the Wednesday night before the tournament for Tennis Plays for Peace in support of victims of the war in Ukraine. And tell us about the success of that event.
It seems every year there's an issue, you know, globally that we support. And this was a special one because there is a large part of our tennis playing community that are adversely affected by this. And they really are good people. I had a long conversation with one of the Ukrainian coaches, and it was a very emotional conversation because, you know, he basically told me that him, the team, and his athletes, they can't go home. Yeah, so when they get on a plane, everyone else can go home. If they want to take a break next week, they can go home.
Yeah.
But he said, next week, we don't know where we're going.
Gosh.
We don't know whether if it's the next tournament, that hotel will be our home. We did our part to support as best as we can the Ukrainian athletes. And it was great to be able to raise money and donate it to you to play for peace. And Ukrainian players participated. Alexei, who's the young Ukrainian male player, was the first time he'd ever qualified for a slam. And he was still playing qualifying then. And I said to him, we're going to have you come and play with these greats of the game. He had never met Rafa. He had never met these players before.
Wow. That's and scary stuff, actually.
It was very, and I could see, and you could see his hands were sweating. And this is a professional player, and he was still in the qualifying. And I said, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to interview you in front of these 15,000 people and millions watching around the world. And his mouth went completely dry. And Todd interviewed him at the beginning of that, and he did a great job. And then he went and played some at the end. And he told me afterwards, he said that was his best tennis experience he ever had in his life. And then he went on and qualified. He played unbelievable tennis, and he got into the main draw. And it was great that he left the country making about $150,000.
Good on him.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And it doesn't stop there, because since the Australian Open has concluded, the horrific scenes coming out of Turkey and Syria from the earthquakes and the tragedy in terms of loss of life and destruction there. But once again, the tennis world comes together.
Yep, and it's just, again, another opportunity for us to use our platform to do good. And we ultimately have that responsibility. We believe it. And the tennis community are filled with really good people that are compassionate, that have a lot of humility and want to help others. And we're a global sport, like soccer is, played in every federation, every country around the world, every region around the world. And I think we have an obligation, and I've always felt that we as an organization have an obligation, particularly to support those in Australia, but then globally, because of the global nature that we are, to do what we can. So we've made a contribution, financial contribution, and we'll continue to do activities as best as we can to support, because we also have tennis players from Turkey and tennis players from Syria that have been, them and their families have been impacted by this tragedy. So, and there'll be more, unfortunately, in the world that will continue to do it, and we'll continue to use the platform. And the seven governing bodies in tennis, probably has this advantage, because it's so many governing bodies, there's resources to do it. But there's the four Grand Slams, the International Tennis Federation, and the men's tour, the ATP, and the women's tour, the WTA, all independent governing bodies. But when it comes to this, we come together very quickly and very easily.
Tennis Plays for Love is the name of this particular fundraising campaign. Another testament to the power of sport and community to rally around social causes. Craig, you'll be delighted to hear that the AO show has now moved to a weekly format. So we'll be hearing, hopefully catching up with you a lot more frequently.
You're going to be busy.
But it's also an opportunity for you to speak to the global audience about the Australian Open and what plans you have in store for AO24. So get your thinking cap on.
I will. We'll save that for the next chat, because we're working through those plans now. But really exciting stuff. You'll see there's going to be the return of some things we missed over the last 3 years for 2024. I don't want to give it away too much, but there's going to be there'll be different things on site people are going to see. An expanded site again people are going to see. I think that we did come to learn. I was really nervous about having, on one day we had 95,000 people on site, and I was really nervous that experience was not going to be good. But the way we spread out the site of the activities, and 24 will be even more, you know, then those people, that amount of people that came could kind of have a good time. But, you know, as long as we're reducing queues and it's easy to get into the venue and it's easy to get something to eat and drink, and that's our objective, to make that as easy as possible each year as well. So, excited to talk about what's coming up.
Build it and they will come. Craig, thank you very much for joining us on the AO show. Off to the United States soon.
Coming up in a couple of weeks, obviously back on the road again, and looking forward to again seeing not only the players, but all, you know, our own team, our Australian team, and Australian team of players. And I've always said that's a great thing about Australia. It's far away, and it's not a great thing when you got to fly.
That's true. When the shoe's on the other foot, it's not great. All right, thanks, Craig. We'll catch up soon.
The team dream continues, and it's into the round of 16. Linda lives on. Listen to this crowd.
She may be the youngest player inside the WTA Top 100, but Linda Fravertova's stunning run to the fourth round of the Australian Open was something to behold. In just her second Grand Slam main draw campaign, the 17-year-old took down Australians Jamie Foulis and Kim Birrell before dispatching fellow Czech Markéta Vondrousova in the third round.
It feels pretty surreal. It's an incredible feeling, and I'm just so happy and excited to be able to say hi, second week, you know.
Fravertova's arrival on the big stage has seemingly come from nowhere. But for those who followed her 2022 season, it's no surprise. At the Miami Open, the then 16-year-old saw off Danka Kovanec, Elisa Mertens and Victoria Azarenka to reach the round of 16. She qualified for the US Open, where she won her first major main draw match against Wang Xinyu, and then the highlight of her year, winning her maiden WTA singles title in Chennai by toppling Australian Open semi-finalist Magda Linette.
I knew I had the level to compete against these kind of players on this high level, but, you know, it's always harder to show it than in the matches, you know, and to win these kind of matches, because the women's level, you know, I think top 100, you know, anybody can beat anybody. So when you have the opportunity, you just got to take it or you lose.
Linda's ability isn't the full extent of the tennis talent in the Fravertova family. Younger sister Brenda is also turning heads after an incredible 2022 season in which she won 8 ITF titles and recorded a 27-match winning streak. The sisters' rapid development certainly helped by their time at the Mouratoglou Academy in France under the direction of Patrick Mouratoglou.
I think those two girls are really, really special. I think they have a huge potential. They're incredible fighters, both of them. They have this this competitiveness on the court that is difficult to teach, because some people are able to play their best when it's important, on the big matches. They find a way to win matches that you don't expect them to win because on the paper, the other one's better. And they're able, during the matches, to feel the moments when they have to press on the accelerator, slow down, play slowly, fast, because they feel the game so much, because they have learned to win.
It's high praise from the man who coached Serena Williams for the last decade of her career. But the sisters are happy carving their own path in tennis.
I don't think it's respectful for Serena and Venus, you know, to talk to such a private things, you know, it's like, and we don't really want people to compare us with Serena and Venus, you know, because they're legends of our sport, and we don't want to, like, copy anybody, you know, we just want to do us.
Linda's success in Melbourne this year has seen her climb another 27 spots to world number 52, firmly entrenching her on the Grand Slam stage, and the teen has no fear pushing the boundaries even further.
I think I'm just staying positive and enjoying my time on the court, serving pretty well and, you know, just sticking to my game and going for it.
You can read more about Linda Fravertova and plenty of other great stories in the Australian Tennis Magazine, available via tennis.mag.com.au. Earlier this season, we brought you a conversation with AusOpen.com's Matt Trelope, and it was about his feature on AusOpen.com called The Kings and Queens of Rod Laver Arena. Welcome back to the AO Show, Matt.
Thanks for having me back. That feels like about 2 years ago now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. let's say a lot of water in the tennis world has gone under the bridge, and part of the reason why we've got you back on the show is to bring us up to date with some of the changes that we've seen to some of your top 10 tables that we discussed during that episode.
Yeah, and thanks to Novak's incredible performance at AO 2023, there was some movement in those tables, and coming into this tournament, that was definitely a narrative or a plot line that I had my eye on, knowing that had he, or should he, play and win all of his matches on Rod Laver Arena, there was every chance that he was going to go on and create some history at Melbourne Park, which is what happened. So, yeah, I guess we can dig into that.
Yeah, we speculated a little bit about it at the time, just, you know, crystal balling what might have played out. But at the most basic level, he was sitting fourth on most match wins before the tournament started with 68.
Yes.
So what's happened now in the rankings order?
Well, so he's gone, by having played and won all 7 of his matches at Rod Laver Arena this year, he now has 75 wins, which puts him, he leapfrogged Nadal into third most wins on the historic table, and now he's only 2 behind Serena Williams, who's 2nd on the list. So, I mean, yeah, that's another, you know, someone else he's kind of clawed back if he doesn't own the record himself already. He probably need to win, What would it be? If he's at 75, he'd need to win three more Australian Opens to overtake Roger Federer, who leads the way with 93 wins at Rod Laver Arena, or two and a half Australian Opens.
Maybe quarterfinal?
Which is, you know, that would put Novak at, what, almost 38 years of age. So I'm not sure if that would happen, but he looks indestructible.
So that's at the most basic level, simple match wins. But then we get a little bit more complex. Let's talk about winning rate.
Yeah, Novak has now played 82 matches at Rod Laver Arena in his career, and he's won 75 of them. So 75 wins and 7 losses, and that puts him in a winning rate of 91.46%.
Ooh.
And that is creeping up to within, what, half a percentage point of Monica Seles, who has the all-time record of 91.89%. And this is for people. Okay, so there are a handful of players who have an undefeated 100% match winning rate at Rod Laver, but they've only played one match.
Right. So what's the cutoff for eligibility to reach, you know, to be in the calculation?
Well, to be honest, it would be two. It'd be two matches, because there's no player that's 2-0 at Rod Laver Arena. There's only...
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's a handful of players that made one appearance on the court, won their match and never returned.
Bizarre.
We can dig into that in another story or series, perhaps.
I presume
about who
it's
those
upset.
People are.
It's got to be a lower ranked player who's produced an upset against a big name.
Correct. And there are some names on there that, like, even a real tennis buff may not be very aware of. So yes, that is a piece in itself. But the criteria I set for this was a minimum of 10 matches at Rod Laver. But apart from the 100%ers, 1-0s, then anyone else is kind of in the running in this stat. So Monica Seles, with 34 wins and 3 losses, has the best winning rate or winning percentage.
And to give people an indication of just how hard it is to improve winning rate, he started the Australian Open at 90.67.
Yes.
And so he's climbed only to...
not even a full percentage point. So so you could see when I was updating the tables every day after the 5 matches at Rod Laver Arena each day, which, you know, got less and less as the tournament went on. Yeah, it was these incremental rises. And we had, I think, worked out before the beginning of the tournament he wouldn't catch Seles even if he won all 7 of his matches. But yeah, he's certainly getting close. So maybe that's something that we could look out for in 2024.
Should we do it now?
Let's crunch it live.
I like bringing up the calculators. So at the moment, he is 75 out of 82.
Yes.
So let's just say he reaches the final again. So let's say he wins 6, all right? Would that be enough? So it would be
81
out of
88.
Yes, is 92%.
So he would have to reach the final next year to overtake Seles, probably, or maybe semi-final?
Let's take it back one. Okay, so let's do 5 wins, all right?
So 80 of 87, is that what we're looking at?
80 of 91.9, so that's it.
Ah, that's it. So he'd have to win his way through to the semi-final. Right, so that's something to look out for next year. But yes, it does take a lot of time, as you said.
The more matches you spend on there, the harder it gets, but the more chances you have to increase it. So luck of the draw in that one. And finally, best winning streak, which I think is the most interesting one of the lot.
Yeah, I love this one.
So beforehand, he appeared on there 3 times, I think.
Potentially 3 times in the top 10. Definitely 2 of the top 5.
He had a 14 that started in 2015.
Okay, I didn't even remember that one. Okay. Yes.
And then he had a 22 that started in 2011 but finished in the quarterfinal of 2014.
Yes. So there was his all-time best winning streak was 22 matches set from 2011 to 2014, and he entered this tournament on a current 21-match winning streak, and that began at the 2019 Australian Open.
Yep.
So that was the winning streak that he built on this time. So with 7 more wins, it took him to 28 consecutive wins. And that was another one that he was kind of chasing Monica Seles on. Well, there were a couple of players ahead of him on that list. So he had to equal his own historic best winning streak of 22. And then he had Andre Agassi, Martina Hingis, both on 25 match winning streak at Rod Laver Arena. And then the best performed was Monica Seles, who had a 26 unbeaten run on that court. So by winning 7, that was something that I really enjoyed watching him kind of tick over and click over and catch these people.
Yeah, and there was a lot written about that, I think, especially when he surpassed Andre Agassi, because, you know, like for like on the men's tour, that was a significant achievement. What about night matches though for Novak Djokovic?
Well, that was something I you know, dug into a little bit more as the tournament got underway. So he's only lost twice at night in the past decade. It's very rare.
I do remember a day match when he lost to Dennis Isterman.
Correct.
That was 2017.
Yes. So that was daytime to Isterman. Then the last loss before that was 2010. That was at night to Songer. But other losses came in the day before that. So, yeah, it's very rare. In fact, his first ever match at Rod Laver Arena was in 2005 against Marat Safin.
So he was the underdog.
At night.
No-namer.
And he lost that, and Safin went on to win the tournament. So his first ever appearance on the court was at night. It wasn't a very successful time for him then.
But it was the champion.
But it was the eventual champion, and he was very young. But he's gone on to build an incredible record at night. His record, his winning streak under lights at Rod Laver Arena currently now stands at 23 wins. And by the time in the men's tournament, if you get deep in the tournament, the semifinals and, well, up until last year, both semifinals plus the final are always at night. So, he's had plenty of, because he always wins here, he's so good at Melbourne Park, he has plenty of opportunities to play at night by virtue of when those matches are scheduled. Yeah, it's one of the toughest tasks in tennis. They say, what is it, Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros, Corfield at Chartres, the toughest test in tennis, this has to be a close second.
Yeah, which is remarkable given the success we've seen from other players previously, that he has become the undisputed king of Melbourne Park. You and I were just discussing off air earlier today that in the 16 Australian Opens that we've each covered, I think I'm right in saying that Novak has won 10 of them. He wasn't even here for one of those. And the other six are shared between three players, Federer with three, Nadal with two, Wawrinka with one.
That's pretty much all we know. Our entire history working and covering this event, Novak pretty much always lifted the trophy. My first Australian Open working here at the tournament was 2008. And I remember that very distinctly because that was the year the courts first became blue. So it's kind of this cool inflection point. And Novak won that year. That was his first Grand Slam title. It's just been the happiest of hunting grounds for him.
There's a stat. He's probably the winningest blue court player In Grand Slam history.
Yes. It's not only the dominance of, like, he's so unbeatable on the court, it's the length of time with which this has happened. So he's got now this amazing stat where his first victory was in 2008, and 15 years later he's still winning. That's getting up with one of the longest ever, I think it's the second longest
span
between first and most recent victory at the same major tournament.
Nadal,
Nadal went 17 years between first and most recent Roland Garros.
Yeah, okay.
And so Djokovic has gone 15 years between first and most recent Australian. Yeah. So the longevity records that are now starting to come out of what Djokovic does, it's an underreported part of his story. I think he's turning 36 in a couple of months. We never talk about his age like we do with other players. His longevity is starting to become one of the defining features of his career.
Which is interesting because he hasn't been unencumbered by injury. There was that period with his elbow 5 years ago where it was, not that it was career threatening by any stretch, but...
Well, it could have been. At the time, we weren't kind of sure what would happen.
But it certainly fell off a cliff.
Yes, but it turned out it wasn't career threatening because of what he's since bounced back to do.
It is interesting. And in the words of Goran Ivanišević, he's from outer space.
Mm.
Djokovic is now third on most number of wins on Rod Laver Arena. He's second, was improved his position in second in terms of winning rate to Monica Seles in first. And he has built upon that longest winning streak to now sit top of the table over Rod Laver Arena's 36-year history, if you include this edition, with 28 match wins in a row for his four championships in a row.
Mm. And I think so now it becomes about, like, what's left to achieve. And I think a couple of things that we could look forward to next year, if Djokovic comes back healthy and keeps winning at Melbourne Park, and this is a statistic that doesn't actually just relate to Rod Laver Arena, this is tournament-wide, would be the longest winning streak at the tournament in its history.
Yep.
So Monica Seles, again, I can't remember if this is Open era or if this is just Melbourne Park specific, but she won 33 matches in a row. So Novak, currently on 28, could surpass that with a deep run next year.
With a quarterfinal.
A quarterfinal victory would see him equal that. And you go back even further, back to the Kooyong days, Margaret Court has a winning streak of, I think it was, we counted it up today, I can't remember, 37 matches?
Yep,
from 1960 to 1967, Australian Open. So, I mean, these are things that Djokovic still...
Or was it beyond 67?
was it 68 where she...
Yes, she missed the 67 tournament, continued her streak in 68 and lost in that final. So, I mean, you know, that's pre-Open era and that's pre-Melbourne Park and very different draw sizes and stuff. But that is, I think, as far as I'm aware, that's probably the record. So that would be two Australian Opens away. There's things for him still to do, and I know he's very, very motivated by records and history and greatness. I'm not even sure if he's aware of these statistics, but if he was, that would give him another thing to shoot for.
Let's make him aware via the AO show and ozopen.com. Matt Trollope, thanks for joining us once again.
A pleasure. Thanks, John.
That's all for this week's episode. Join me again next week for the latest tennis news, views and interviews. And before we go, happy birthday to John McEnroe, Alex Deminor, who celebrated with a win over Andrei Rublev overnight, and Madison Keys, all celebrating birthdays this week. If it's your birthday coming up, let us know via ozopen.com/listen or email theaoshow@tennis.com.au. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like what you hear, please rate and review so more fans can discover the AO Show.